Welcome to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Rocco Pendola, editor at Seeking Alpha. Good afternoon, my friend.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. Listeners, Rocco and I have known each other for quite a while, not decades, but years, and so this podcast is going to have a slightly different flavor than some of the other podcasts I've done. It's going to sound like two Italian buddies sitting on an outdoor cafe, drinking an Italian soda and basking in the sunlight and just chatting away.
So, as it should be.
As it should be. I first met you, I think, when you popped up on my radar either through Twitter or through the street. I think it might have been both about the same time. And then I discovered some furious activity from you on Twitter. You were, let's see, what was it, social media director there?
Yeah, I was a contributor at the street for a while, and then when I took a full-time job there, I became the social media director and also a writer at the same time.
What was your responsibility on the social media part on Twitter? What was that all about?
Well, I think the problem that a lot of media outlets face, especially smaller ones, is that they're always trying to drive traffic from social media, from Twitter, from Facebook, from LinkedIn, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And the street was no exception. So they saw that I had done a pretty decent job at building a following on Twitter, and they figured, well, maybe he can use some of his knowledge to parlay that into doing the same at the street. And I'll be honest with you, it didn't go well. We tried a lot of different things, and we had some successes. But I think social media remains a very confusing area, especially for financial websites. And I don't know what it is. I haven't quite figured all of that out yet. But it was my job to increase traffic, and I wouldn't say it really happened in any significant way.
Do you think that maybe the psychology of the button-down investor doesn't take them to sort of hanging around on Twitter? Is that part of it?
I think it might be. We were trying to do this at a time when Business Insider was making headlines. And one of the things that I attempted to relay to people was it's really difficult to get Business Insider results on social media when you're not doing Business Insider type content. It's they have stuff and they do stuff that is very shareable, and they're willing to branch out into many different areas. Their focus as a business website is quite broad. So I'm not saying it's easy to do what they do, but it's certainly, I think, more conducive to sharing, more conducive to a younger audience, and it's difficult to get the results that a site like that or even a Mashable or something gets when your focus is so defined at a place like the street, and the same with what I deal with now at Seeking Alpha.
Well, before we talk about your departure, I want to talk about how you got there. What were you doing in your earlier days and career that led you to writing for the street? How does one get there?
Yeah, it's a long story, and I'll do my best to distill it into something that is easily consumable, so we have other things to talk about. I think it goes back to when I was a kid growing up in Niagara Falls, New York, just outside of Buffalo in Western New York. I was obsessed with radio. To say I was obsessed is probably an understatement. When I was in grade school, I would spend my days with a Walkman in my pocket and the earphone from the headset up through my long sleeve shirt, cupped in my hand, with my arm, you know, resting, my elbow resting on the desk, and I would listen to talk radio all day during school. And when I got home, or after school, there would be maybe a baseball practice, playing with friends, doing homework, having dinner. But after that, I was in my room listening to Top 40 radio all night, dreaming about being the Top 40 disc jockey at night. And then when I would go to sleep, I'd have that same Walkman, and I'd listen to talk radio from all around the country, because you can get – I could get stations from close to where you are. I could get stations – I could get KOA in Denver late at night from Niagara Falls. And I would listen to everything and wake up in the morning with the headphones tangled around me. I would often wake up to Imus in the Morning on WFAN in New York at the time.
Reminds me of being a kid and listening to WLS in Chicago.
Yep, I would
same
listen to
thing.
The Loop in Chicago was a great station. So there were so many great radio stations, and I was obsessed with them all. And I started calling a really small local radio station in Niagara Falls every single morning before school. And I became, albeit on a station with a very small reach, a bit of a mini celebrity, because my thing was to bash all of the Buffalo sports teams, because my grandmother hated the Buffalo sports teams and I followed in her path. And long story short, I would nag the people at that station to hire me to do anything. And when I turned 13 in 1988, shortly after I turned 13, they did hire me. And I was a producer of the talk shows and so forth. I had on the weekend. I did news and sports updates. And probably within a year after that, I was hosting a sports talk show on that station. So that progressed to the point where I said, okay, this is great, but I want to go work for some of the bigger Buffalo stations. And I guess when I was 15 or 16, I got hired at a music station in Buffalo. About a year after that, I was able to get a job at the talk station in Buffalo, producing, doing some of my own shows. And after I graduated high school, it was clear that I wanted to do radio. So I just applied everywhere and asked everybody for advice. You know, what can I do to get a full-time job somewhere? And just as I was 19 turning 20, I had a couple of offers, one in Denver, actually, at the Fan there, and the other at a radio station in Miami. And I decided to go to Miami. So I had a radio career, a full-time career that spanned a good 6 or 7 years. And it ended in 99-2000 after getting fired at a station in Dallas. And that's a real long story. But it's, you know, everybody gets fired at least once.
It happens more often than you would think.
Yeah. And in radio, it happens way more often than you might think. And that's when I had a bit of a change in direction in my career and didn't really know what to do. So I ended up in San Francisco because I started having this real attraction to living in the city. And I decided to take this sales job, selling sports hospitality packages to big companies and to dot-coms during the big, you know, the first dot-com surge in 99-2000.
What is a sports hospitality package?
You're the VP of sales at a company. You're a CEO of a company, and you want to take your clients to, say, the Masters or the Super Bowl. You would purchase a package from us, which would include tickets and hospitality. So dinner or a place to stay and hang out and relax when you're not watching the game or out in the course watching the golf. And you pay good money for that. And our sales pitch was basically like stock guys in a boiler room. We would it was all inside sales, cold calling, getting the decision makers on the phone and really badgering them to buy stuff. But we had a good product. So
you were not the meet and greet guy. You were just the guy on the phone who did the sales.
If you ever saw the movie Boiler Room, where it was this fake brokerage selling fake stock, we weren't faking anything. Again, we had a legitimate product, but the sales pitch was basically the same. So 9/11 happened while I was working there. And many of us sort of reassessed everything we were doing after 9/11. It was obviously a pretty sobering event. And I said, well, I bypassed college because of my radio obsession, so it's time to go to college. And given that I had this developing love for cities, I decided to study urban planning. And I did that at San Francisco State for 4 years. I went on to graduate school and started a PhD in Irvine for a couple of years.
Oh, I didn't know that. PhD work. Awesome.
I did. I dropped out of it, but didn't go work at Starbucks. And basically, the reason why I tell this story is because I've always been a bit of a personality, I guess, in media. And one thing that was constant through it all was I always also had a love for the stock market. So when I was in Dallas, I did a weekly show where I actually had Joe Kernan on every week from CNBC, and we would do the stock picking thing every week on the station that I worked at. So I always had that thing happening. And when I decided to drop out of graduate school, I said, well, what do I want to do with my life? And writing was the one thing I felt like I was good at and I was passionate about. And that's when all of a sudden I discovered Seeking Alpha and said, wow, there's this platform where they'll let you go on and share your investing insights and they'll let you develop it and you can learn about investing from other people. So it was very similar to building yourself up as a personality in radio, except this was just being done in print and being done from a website that was all about giving anybody the opportunity to do that as long as they could write well and could build a following and can share, you know, reasonably insightful investment insights.
So being a disc jockey, I'm betting, helped you with that outreach, that confidence in speaking to people, plus the sales. just, you know, meet and greet, talk, relate, share. Yeah.
Exactly. I feel like it all sort of ties together. And it also gives you, not that I haven't had trouble dealing with some of the reaction you get, because much of it is negative, but I think it also gives you maybe a thicker skin than other people might have. Because when you do this type of thing, and especially if you are on the more provocative side, you deal with reaction that can sometimes be difficult to handle.
I had a similar experience when I was in high school. It was time to get a summer job, and I had been visiting the YMCA in previous years, and I thought, you know, they had a swimming pool, and they had athletic courts, and they had youth center with ping pong tables and all sorts of stuff going on, and I thought, this would be a great place to work. So I maneuvered to corner one of the vice presidents while he was eating in the cafe, and just walked up to his table and sat down with him and said, hi, introduced myself, told him how I had been going to the YMCA for years and years, loved the place, I wanted to work there. And he said, you know, we need somebody in the athletic department downstairs to, you know, take care of passing out towels and doing laundry and working the desk downstairs. So let me introduce you to the athletic director. And so he walked me back there, and I had a job within 15 minutes. Just sometimes if you just ask, right? It's the right, being in the right time in the right place, or just being persistent. Yeah, it can really pay off.
Yeah, and the part of the story I didn't tell was that before they hired me, the guy who works Sunday nights at this small station, I don't know how I even got into contact with him, but I said, hey, can I come by on Sunday night and just see how it works? I want to learn what you do. And he was great. He said, yeah, come on out. So every Sunday, at first my mother would drop me off and pick me up, but then when we got to know him and knew that he wasn't a freak, he would actually come pick me up, and we're friends to this day. And he taught me everything about how to do everything at a radio station, and that is probably the reason why I was capable enough to actually do the job on my own when they were gracious enough to hire me.
Yeah, that's another important aspect of developing your career, is having a mentor. If you're in a situation where you don't feel like there's somebody who's likes you and they're looking out for you, and you're mentor, they're not mentoring you, then perhaps it's time to move on and find a situation that's better for your career. And you have a supporter that always helps, makes all the difference.
It does. I have so many people that are, you know, that's what I try to do now. I mean, not that I'm an old guy or have all of this wisdom, but I think that there are a lot of young people that write for Seeking Alpha, and they reach out for advice, and I try to give it, because I can list so many people that helped me when I was in radio and now, you know, as a writer or whatever, that it's all so invaluable, and it's all kind of random, you know. It just, yeah, you go after some of the things, like the story you told or the story that I told, but some of it just kind of happens, and it's, you feel like, wow, there's something in the universe looking out for me and helping, you know, guide me to learn how to do something or make a good decision or whatever.
One of the things I notice in watching television is that for the sake of brevity and to get the action moving, so many people on TV arrive already accomplished. They're in their 40s, or they're in their 30s, and all of a sudden you see a young person who's maybe, you know, 28, and they're an astronaut, and they're the senior research director of a major research institution. They have a PhD, and they've got 10 PhDs working for them, and they're 28 years old. It just doesn't happen that way. It takes a long time to develop a career. My wife is a professor, and she's discovering that her young programming students, you know, 18 to 25, they're not quite tuned into the idea that they're learning, they're starting, they're building a foundation, and they get frustrated that they're not accomplished, and that they can't go to work for Lucasfilm tomorrow and start doing 3D rendering graphics and modeling of hair and water and Frozen and things like that. They're struggling through just the idea that they have to master something before they can move on to something else and build on that. It takes a long time.
Yeah, I think the fast pace of our society and the things that we use every day, Facebook and Netflix and Pandora, they all have stories behind them of hard work and luck, and there's a timeline behind all of those things. Yeah. But I think the public perception is that they just kind of cropped up overnight, and look at this great success. So, you know, I don't have to do any work. And again, the reality of those stories are they're not overnight successes, but they do, in some contexts, appear that way. And I think especially for younger people who are, this is what they're using. They're using those products every day or those services. It's easy to fall into that trap of, I don't have to work. I should just, you know, have this incredible success overnight. But right. Obviously, you know, that's not the case.
Well, this is a good place for a break. Folks, I want to get a short commercial announcement in here from Kelly, and we will be back in 60 seconds.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you very much, Kelly. We are back. Rocco, do you mind if I ask you about Sears?
Of course. Of course.
I thought that was a fascinating piece of work that you were doing. What year was that? Was that 13?
I guess it was 2013, 14. And I have to give credit to Brian Sazi, who is, I think he's still at the Street as their retail reporter. He spearheaded a lot of that. I sort of rode his coattails a bit. But together, I think we did some interesting things on Sears.
You know, as technical writers, we tend to get wrapped up in reading and technology and writing. But there is a different class of people who actually go out and, you know, you see them on TV and talk to people and interview and visit and take notes and do video and collect a story and tell a story. And I was fascinated by what you were doing with Sears. Tell the listeners basically what was going on there.
Well, Sears, as we all know, has had some trouble, and they Brian, again, was the one who got this idea of going into their stores and taking pictures of what a mess things are, literally a mess. And then, I guess, more in the figurative sense, to use it as an illustration for what this means for the company and means for their stock. And I started doing that locally in part to see, am I going to get the same results as he does? Is this sort of a one-off thing, or is it more of a pattern across the organization? And my feeling is that it ended up being the latter. So I would go to stores around here and take pictures and post them, encourage other people to do the same wherever they lived. And there was one particular article where everything just came together so well. The article posted on the Street on a Saturday morning right after the new year. I think there was a snowstorm or something, so everybody was in the house. And Yahoo's homepage picked up the story, which is always a big traffic driver. And I think that story got 1 million or 2 million page views, which for the Street is a lot. Most of my articles in the Street, if they did well, would be like, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 page views. So it took off. And it got the attention of Sears, and their, I forget the guy's title, maybe their VP of communications or something at the time, made an error. He went on Twitter and basically started defending the company and referred to shorts in the stock who are behind this sort of thing, which couldn't have been further from the truth, and really talked himself into a corner and made himself look bad. And so some other media outlets, I think Huffington Post and some retail websites, picked up the story. And I wouldn't necessarily say that it went viral, given the extent to the way things go viral now, but it was pretty close. And it was bad press for Sears. And I think it was a lesson in how to not handle that sort of reporting. And some people wouldn't call it reporting. I think that it is.
I think it was perfect reporting. Yeah.
I appreciate that because I think the analysis behind it was sound, and I think there were other components that we included that discussed why Sears wasn't a good investment or why the company was a mess. And this was just a visual illustration of it that I think did become the focus, but complemented the larger case against Sears at the time.
Is that fellow still with Sears?
I don't know. I should check. And we talked afterwards on the phone a few times. He was a good guy. He admitted he made a mistake. I mean, listen, it's Saturday morning. This happens, and he's an aggressive guy like me, and he wanted to deal with it. and he made some decisions that I'm sure he's learned from. And we talked after, and he was great. You know, I was willing to work with him to make sure that he knew what was coming after. You know, I wouldn't not print something because of him, but I said, listen, here's what we're going to do, and here's why. And unless you have an amazing argument to keep us from doing it, we're going to do it, but at least you know about it.
Now, you're with Seeking Alpha now. Have you revisited any of those stores out of curiosity?
I have not. Haven't been writing as much since I joined Seeking Alpha, and I'm more looking at the tech and the media stocks now, so I haven't really revisited Sears anytime recently.
So what is your official title at Seeking Alpha?
I'm an editor of technology and media, but I do a bit more than that now. The great thing about Seeking Alpha, for folks who don't know what Seeking Alpha is, it's basically a crowdsourced investment research platform, and we're growing. We have a great community of investors who either just use the site to try to become better investors or who actually share their investment insights by writing articles. And the beauty of the place is that it truly is a startup. They will let people that have ideas and they're not afraid to share them, and that want to go out and try to do something, they will let you take something and run with it. And that's such a great environment to be in, right? I mean, it's one of the first places I've worked where they really, truly empower you and say, hey, if you've got something you want to do, take ownership of it, go after it. So I'm doing a lot of different things in addition to focusing on finding the best tech and media articles and making them the best they can be before they get on the site.
Now, the other day you told me that you were also involved in a coaching program. Tell me about that.
We're going to be rolling something out in the next few weeks that we think just takes the next step in partnering with our authors, trying to help them always improve their content. What we get is great, but everything that's great can always be better. And we always have authors who are reaching out to us, asking us, what can I do to make this article better? Or you declined this one. You know, what is it that I can do to not get declined next time? Or I understand this feedback, but how do I implement it? You know, there's so many different queries we get every day. And the nature of our job as editors is that we can't really adequately deal with them every day because it's just a time and resource thing. So I've come up with an idea that was triggered by basically my boss came to me and said, here's one idea of something we think we want to work on. Can you take it and expand it and bring the editorial perspective to it? And I came up with this idea for a way that we can work more closely with authors to basically, again, better partner with them and help remedy some of the things that they come to us with something that is going to be manageable for both sides. So it's exciting. I'm looking forward to doing it, and we hope to have it live and ready to go at the beginning of March.
Awesome. So you've been kind of manipulating or reinvigorating your Twitter account. I saw this morning that you started a new account. Yeah. What's going on with that? Because you had quite a few followers, many more than I have, by the way.
I was lucky enough, thanks to The Street primarily, and thanks to Jim Cramer, who got behind me for a while, to have close to 8,000 followers. And long story short, I am guilty at times of making impulsive decisions or stopping and starting and sort of getting restless and just sort of doing things that maybe don't seem to make a lot of sense to people, but in my head they do. And there was a period before I joined Seeking Alpha where I was really just disenchanted with social media. I felt like it was taking up too much of my life, and I felt like I was spending just way too much time on it when I could be doing other things, especially when you consider that my job has me in front of a computer anywhere from 8 to 12 or even some days 15 hours a day. I wanted to do other things with other time. Primarily, I wanted to start reading books again, which sort of had just fallen by the wayside for a couple of years. So I said, you know what? I'm blowing everything up. I blew up the Facebook account. I blew up Twitter. And I didn't blow up LinkedIn, but I didn't go to LinkedIn for like a year. And then recently, I said, okay, you know, maybe it's time to go back. I'm not going back to Facebook. That won't happen. But with Twitter, I felt like there's a use for it now. And it'll be a challenge to see if maybe I can, you know, get closer to the number that I had without, you know,
Jim Cramer tweeting my stuff. What is the name of that new account?
I think I called it Not As Composed, which is – so it's at Not As Composed. And the – not to get all like theoretical and philosophical on you, but I'm a big fan of songwriters. And Elliot Smith is a late songwriter out of Portland who lived and unfortunately died in L.A., who is one of the best there is. And he has a song – That there's a lyric in the song that says, "You toss the empty beer, you're not as composed as you appear." And I think what he says is, what he's saying there is that, you know, people put on these fronts, right? We're all big and tough and we know what we're doing all the time, and you want to appear composed in front of people. But the reality is that most of us really aren't. We all are scared of something and we all have vulnerabilities, and we try to hide behind these facades that we put on. So I really like that message that is in that particular song, and figured that was a good name for a Twitter account, for somebody that writes. There's just a whole bunch of playing on words and different feelings that I have that goes into that.
Did you find yourself in a situation where you felt like you needed to sort of feed and satisfy the 8,000 followers? They were depending on you in some way for entertainment or for...
I wouldn't say that, because kind of going back to the thing that I said at the very beginning about the street and the engagement on social media, I didn't have really great engagement. I felt part of my discontent was I felt like you tweet something and it just kind of goes into this black hole and nobody notices it. So why am I spending all this time trying to find the formula to make people notice what I'm saying on Twitter when it's just going into this vacuum? Or at least that's how it felt to me 95% of the time. So I don't know. It was mainly just restlessness and discontent with the pervasiveness of social media. And then, yeah, this idea that you do things and they just kind of fall flat, and probably through no fault of your own. And then, you know, the Twitter lynch mob. Somebody makes a mistake. Right. And for whatever reason, in certain instances, people just go after them. And I mean, that girl that made that tweet from South Africa, I forget her name. She worked for the company that has Tinder or whatever. I forget. She made this horribly racist tweet when she was flying to South Africa, but she made a mistake. And I think they ruined her life for a couple of years. And that was one thing that happened where I just said, wow, do I really want to be such a part of this? It just made me want to step back for a bit.
Yeah, Twitter can be something where there's multiple levels of engagement. There's complete callous stranger interaction, and people feel at liberty to say things that would get them punched if they did it face to face. And then there's the casual technical engagement between people. I follow a lot of authors because I want to know what they're writing. And then there's personal communication. It's a really quick way to touch bases with a friend without having to fuss with an email program, and just send notes real quick and create a sense of family and community amongst a small group of people, writers, things like
and
that.
And I met you. I've met other people like you through Twitter. I mean, that's the beauty of it, right? Is you get to make these connections you might not have otherwise made. And since I restarted my account, I've had people find me that I know and that I've followed before, and opportunities have come up. This podcast is one example of that.
Those are probably what you would call high-value followers or something along those lines, where there's a real sense of connection instead of just the jazz of celebrityship.
So much noise on Twitter, and yeah, this idea of, oh, well, it's the modern-day autograph. You know, will somebody follow me or acknowledge my tweet? And that's just not comfortable with that mindset, I guess.
So what do you feel about – I want to ask you just a couple more questions, and we're just about out of time. How are you feeling about Apple these days? By the way, what kind of Mac do you use? I assume you're a Mac user.
I have a mid-2012 MacBook Pro with Retina display. Love it. Cool. I hope it lasts forever.
Cool.
It's a great computer. You know, I don't know how I feel about Apple these days. I hate to be wishy-washy, but I was part of an article that our dividend and incomes editor on the street published on Monday morning. And the subject of the article was about dividends, obviously, and whether or not tech companies signal an end to growth when they decide to start paying a dividend. And of course, that was a big thing with Apple while they were deciding what they were going to do. And it's a big thing with Google now. And one of the things I said in that interview was that I take various perspectives at the same time. So often competing perspectives. Because sometimes I'm just not sure, but other times it's
when
because
I feel
like...
When I do that, I catch it.
Right, yeah, so do I. It's a dangerous way to be.
But there are nuanced discussions in this field.
Right, exactly, right? Nothing is black and white. Being right or wrong is fleeting. It changes within a week, sometimes within hours or days.
Or you would-be writers, mark that down in your notes.
Right. So I don't want to focus on that, right? What I think my biggest value for myself in trying to become smarter and grow. And I think the biggest value I could relay to people that read the stuff that I write is to investigate these different perspectives. So one day it might be the perspective of, is Tim Cook driving Apple down this dead-end road to where it's just going to turn into any other company? And the next day it might be, you know what, Tim Cook seems to be coming into the job here. One day it might be Apple Music is a failure. The next day it might be Apple should buy Pandora. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be married to any of these things, right? But you're investigating them and trying to flesh them out and trying to start a conversation around them. And through that conversation, going to Seeking Alpha's focus, hopefully people will pull things that help them make better investment decisions or make more sense of a stock or a company that they're following.
You know, when I was a young astrophysics student, I took a lot of philosophy because it was the social courses that I could stomach in my physics and mathematics career. And so I took a lot of philosophy classes to meet those requirements. And what I discovered was that sometimes it's useful to talk about something, to explore avenues, to go down various paths and engage people in a discussion. You may not know where you're going. And like you said a second ago, it may not be self-consistent all the time. I find myself as a writer often taking my readers down a certain path and exploring avenues with them for fun and education. And then later I'll find that it's fruitful, as you said, to explore a different avenue. And the readers go, but Martellaro, last week you said this. Yeah. You know, there is no such thing as perfect consistency in this editorializing and vastly complicated technical area.
Yeah, you're having a conversation with the readers. But to answer your question, the one thing I keep going back to on Apple with all of the concerns and all the questions is, for two quarters in a row, right, they've sold 75 million iPhones. I mean, that is incredible. I don't know if you need to know anything else. I don't know if you even need to go, oh, is iPhone too much of what they're doing? Oh, do they have anything next? They've sold, am I right? Right?
It works out to something like 34,000 an hour for 13 weeks in a row.
150 million iPhones in 6 months. That's mind-boggling. Just mind-blowing.
I've talked to some investors, and their attitude is that Apple had lots of growth, and then things seem to be kind of leveling off, and the economy is slowing down, and Apple's projection for the next quarter was not so rosy, and investors get kind of skittish when they don't see the kind of wonderful growth that allows them to make lots of money, and they get nervous and they don't realize that, you know, these things, they do realize it, but they can't quantify it. And I was talking to Jan Dawson a little while ago, and it's hard to put some of these subjective things into a spreadsheet and do analysis. And when it fails the ability to mathematically represent it, then you find yourself throwing up your hands and saying, well, gee, I just don't know what's going to happen. And then that kind of inability to see the future really, really well creates a sense of angst. But I think the iPhone will continue to grow and morph and have new features. And when the iPhone 7 comes out, people will be back on the bandwagon again, and things will be all cool. And Apple will continue to develop the iPhone as this marvelous device we carry around. So,
yeah. There, I think there are logical inconsistencies too with investing, right? Like Microsoft, that stock is highly valued in some respects right now. And I like the Microsoft story, actually. And I think there are inconsistencies that exist when you think about a company like Microsoft. It's compared to Apple, it's relatively highly valued. I like Microsoft. I think it's a great company. I think they're making good decisions. But you have to be careful not to give into that emotion, because the stock market is not logical. It doesn't always make perfect decisions that are in line with one another. And if you get too emotional about it, you can get yourself in trouble, which I think a lot of people, if they bought Apple here in the last couple of months, are finding out the hard way.
Yeah. Well, we've had a few technical problems during the show, and I'm afraid that if we continue on, Skype is going to be not our friend in this process. And we have gone about 35 minutes, so I think it's a good place to wrap it up. I'd love to talk to you longer, as I always do with everyone on the show. I'd like to thank you for your taking the time to share your insights with us. Fascinating story about how you got to be where you are. That's why I do Background Mode, is to hear these stories about how people arrived at where they are. So it's been fascinating, and thanks, my old friend, for being on the show with me.
Thanks, John. It was great. I really appreciate you having me on.
And we talked about how people can find you at Seeking Alpha.
Yep, I'm at Seeking Alpha. Just type in my name, and my profile comes up. You can follow me there. And then, of course, on Twitter, at Not As Composed.
Great. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you for coming by. We had a lot of fun on this one, and we'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.